to keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering. Have we learned this first principle of conservation? To preserve all the parts of the land mechanism? No, because even the scientist does not yet recognize all of them. In Germany, there is a mountain called the Spessart. Its south slope bears the most magnificent oaks in the world. American cabinet makers, when they want the last word in quality, use Spessart oak. The north slope, which should be the better, bears an indifferent stand of Scotch pine. Why? Both slopes are part of the same state forest. Both have been managed with equally scrupulous care for two centuries. Why the difference? Kick up the litter under the oak, and you will see that the leaves rot almost as fast as they fall. Under the pines, though, the needles pile up as a thick duff. Decay is much slower. Why? Because in the Middle Ages, the south slope was preserved as a deer forest by a hunting bishop. The north slope was pastured, plowed, and cut by settlers, just as we do with our woodlots in Wisconsin and Iowa today. Only after this period of abuse was the north slope replanted to pines. During this period of abuse, something happened to the microscopic flora and fauna of the soil. The number of species was greatly reduced, i.e., the digestive apparatus of the soil lost some of its parts. Two centuries of conservation have not sufficed to restore these losses. It required the modern microscope and a century of research in soil science to discover the existence of these small cogs and wheels which determine harmony or disharmony between men and land in the Spessart. For the biotic community to survive, its internal processes must balance, else its member species would disappear. That particular communities do survive for long periods is well known. Wisconsin, for example, in 1840, had substantially the same soil, fauna, and flora as at the end of the Ice Age, i.e. 12,000 years ago. We know this because the bones of its animals and the pollens of its plants are preserved in the peat bogs. The successive strata of peats, with their differing abundance of pollens, even record the weather. Thus, around 3000 BC, an abundance of ragweed pollen indicates either a series of droughts, or a great stamping of buffalo, or severe fires on the prairie. These recurring exigencies did not prevent the survival of the 350 kinds of birds, 90 mammals, 150 fishes, 70 reptiles, or the thousands of insects and plants. That all these should survive as an internally balanced community for so many centuries shows an astonishing stability in the original biota. Science cannot explain the mechanisms of stability, but even a layman can see two of its effects. One, fertility, when extracted from rocks, circulated through such elaborate food chains that it accumulated as fast or faster than it washed away. Two, this geological accumulation of soil fertility paralleled the diversification of flora and fauna. Stability and diversity were apparently interdependent. American conservation is, I fear, still concerned for the most part with showpieces. We have not yet learned to think in terms of small cogs and wheels. Look at our own backyard, at the prairies of Iowa and southern Wisconsin. What is the most valuable part of the prairie? The fat black soil, the Chernozem. Who built the Chernozem? The black prairie was built by the prairie plants, 100 distinctive species of grasses, herbs, and shrubs. By the prairie fungi, insects, and bacteria. By the prairie mammals and birds, all interlocked in one humming community of cooperations and competitions. One biota. This biota, through 10,000 years of living and dying, burning and growing, praying and fleeing, freezing and thawing, built that dark and bloody ground we call prairie. Our grandfathers did not, could not, know the origin of their prairie empire. They killed off the prairie fauna and they drove the flora to a last refuge on railroad embankments and roadsides. To our engineers, this flora is merely weeds and brush. They ply it with grader and mower. Through processes of plant succession, predictable by any botanist, the prairie garden becomes a refuge for quackgrass. After the garden is gone, the highway department employs landscapers to dot the quack with elms and with artistic clumps of scotch pine, Japanese barberry, and spirea. Conservation committees, en route to some important convention, whiz by and applaud this zeal for roadside beauty. Someday we may need this prairie flora not only to look at, but to rebuild the wasting soil of prairie farms. Many species may then be missing. We have our hearts in the right place, but we do not yet recognize the small cogs and wheels. In our attempts to save the bigger cogs and wheels, we are still pretty naive. A little repentance just before a species goes over a brink is enough to make us feel virtuous. When the species is gone, we have a good cry and repeat the performance. The recent extermination of the grizzly from most of the western stock-raising states is a case in point. Yes, we still have grizzlies in the Yellowstone, but the species is ridden by imported parasites. The rifles wait on every refuge boundary. New dude ranches and new roads constantly shrink the remaining range. Every year sees fewer grizzlies on fewer ranges in fewer states. We console ourselves with the comfortable fallacy that a single museum piece will do, ignoring the clear dictum of history that a species must be saved in many places if it is to be saved at all. We need knowledge, public awareness, of the small cogs and wheels, but sometimes I think there is something we need even more. It is the thing that Forest and Stream, on its editorial masthead, once called a refined taste in natural objects. Have we made any headway in developing a refined taste in natural objects? In the northern parts of the Lake States, we have a few wolves left. Each state offers a bounty on wolves. In addition, it may invoke the expert services of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in wolf control. Yet both this agency and the several conservation commissions complain of an increasing number of localities where there are too many deer for the available feed. Foresters complain of periodic damage from too many rabbits. Why, then, continue the public policy of wolf extermination? We debate such questions in terms of economics and biology. The mammalogists assert the wolf is the natural check on too many deer. The sportsmen reply they will take care of excess deer. Another decade of argument, and there will be no wolves to argue about. One conservation inkpot cancels another. In the Lake States, we are proud of our forest nurseries and of the progress we are making in replanting what was once the North Woods. But look in these nurseries, and you will find no white cedar, no tamarack. Why no cedar? It grows too slowly. The deer eat it. The alders choke it. The prospect of a cedarless North Woods does not depress our foresters. Cedar has, in effect, been purged on grounds of economic inefficiency. For the same reason, beech has been purged from the future forests of the Southeast. To these voluntary expungements of species from our future flora, we must add the involuntary ones arising from the importation of diseases: chestnut, persimmon, white pine. Is it sound economics to regard any plant as a separate entity, to proscribe or encourage it on the grounds of its individual performance? What will be the effect on animal life, on the soil, and on the health of the forest as an organism? A refined taste in natural objects perceives that the economic issue is a separate consideration. We who are the heirs and assigns of Paul Bunyan have not found out either what we are doing to the river or what the river is doing to us. We burl our logs of state with more energy than skill. We have radically modified the biotic stream. We had to. Food chains now begin with corn and alfalfa instead of oaks and bluestem. flow through cows, hogs, and poultry, instead of into elk, deer, and grouse, thence into farmers, flappers, and freshmen, instead of Indians. That the flow is voluminous, you can determine by consulting the telephone directory, or the roster of government agencies. The flow in this biotic stream is probably much greater than in the pre-Bunyan eras. But curiously enough, science has never measured this. Tame animals and plants have no tenacity as links in the new food chain. They are maintained, artificially, by the labor of farmers, aided by tractors, and abetted by a new kind of animal, the professor of agriculture. Paul Bunyan's birling was self-taught. Now we have a prof standing on the bank giving free instruction. Each substitution of a tame plant or animal for a wild one, or an artificial waterway for a natural one, is accompanied by a readjustment in the circulating system of the land. We do not understand or foresee these readjustments. We are unconscious of them unless the end effect is bad. Whether it be the president rebuilding Florida for a ship canal, or Farmer Jones rebuilding a Wisconsin meadow for cow pasture, we are too busy with new tinkerings to think of end effects. That so many tinkerings are painless attests the youth and elasticity of the land organism. One of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Much of the damage inflicted on land is quite invisible to laymen. An ecologist must either harden his shell and make believe that the consequences of science are none of his business, or he must be the doctor who sees the marks of death in a community that believes itself well and does not want to be told otherwise. The government tells us we need flood control and comes to straighten the creek in our pasture. The engineer on the job tells us the creek is now able to carry off more flood water, but in the process, we have lost our old willows where the owl hooted on a winter night and under which the cows switched flies in the noon shade. We lost the little marshy spot where our fringed gentians bloomed. Hydrologists have demonstrated that the meanderings of a creek are a necessary part of the hydrologic functioning. The floodplain belongs to the river. The ecologist sees clearly that for similar reasons, we can get along with less channel improvement on Round River. Now to appraise the new order in terms of the two criteria. One, does it maintain fertility? Two, does it maintain a diverse fauna and flora? Soils in the first stages of exploitation display a burst of plant and animal life. The abundant crops that evoked Thanksgiving in the pioneers are well known, but there was also a burst of wild plants and animals. A score of imported food-bearing weeds had been added to the native flora. The soil was still rich, and landscape had been diversified by patches of plowland and pasture. The abundance of wildlife reported by the pioneers was in part the response to this diversity. Such high metabolism is characteristic of newfound lands. It may represent normal circulation, or it may represent the combustion of stored fertility, i.e., biotic fever. One cannot distinguish the fever from normality by asking the biota to bite a thermometer. It can only be told ex post facto by the effect on the soil. What was the effect? The answer is written in gullies on 1,000 fields. Crop yields per acre have remained about stationary. The vast technological improvements in farming have only offset the wastage in soil. In some regions, such as the Dust Bowl, the biotic stream has already shrunk below the point of navigability, and Paul's heirs have moved to California to ferment the grapes of wrath. As for diversity, what remains of our native fauna and flora remains only because agriculture has not got around to destroying it. The present ideal of agriculture is clean farming. Clean farming means a food chain aimed solely at economic profit and purged of all non-conforming links, a sort of Pax Germanica of the agricultural world. Diversity, on the other hand, means a food chain aimed to harmonize the wild and the tame in the joint interest of stability, productivity, and beauty. Clean farming, to be sure, aspires to rebuild the soil, but it employs to this end only imported plants, animals, and fertilizers. It sees no need for the native flora and fauna that built the soil in the first place. Can stability be synthesized out of imported plants and animals? Is fertility that comes in sacks sufficient? These are the questions at issue. No living man really knows. Testifying for the workability of clean farming is northeastern Europe, where a degree of biotic stability has been retained, except in humans, despite the wholesale artificialization of the landscape. Testifying for its non-workability are all the other lands where it has ever been tried, including our own, and the tacit evidence of evolution, in which diversity and stability are so closely intertwined as to seem two names for one fact. I had a bird dog named Gus. When Gus couldn't find pheasants, he worked up an enthusiasm for sora rails and meadowlarks. This whipped up zeal for unsatisfactory substitutes masked his failure to find the real thing. It assuaged his inner frustration. We conservationists are like that. We set out a generation ago to convince the American landowner to control fire, to grow forests, to manage wildlife. He did not respond very well. We have virtually no forestry, and mighty little range management, game management, wildflower management, pollution control, or erosion control being practiced voluntarily by private landowners. In many instances, the abuse of private land is worse than it was before we started. If you don't believe that, watch the straw stacks burn on the Canadian prairies. Watch the fertile mud flowing down the Rio Grande. Watch the gullies climb the hillsides in the Palouse, in the Ozarks, in the river breaks of southern Iowa and western Wisconsin. To assuage our inner frustration over this failure, we have found us a meadowlark. I don't know which dog first caught the scent. I do know that every dog on the field whipped into an enthusiastic backing point. I did myself. The meadowlark was the idea that if the private landowner won't practice conservation, let's build a bureau to do it for him. Like the meadowlark, this substitute has its good points. It smells like success. It is satisfactory on poor land, which bureaus can buy. The trouble is that it contains no device for preventing good private land from becoming poor public land. There is danger in the assuagement of honest frustration. It helps us forget we have not yet found a pheasant. I'm afraid the meadowlark is not going to remind us. He is flattered by his sudden importance. Considering the prodigious achievements of the profit motive in wrecking land, one hesitates to reject it as a vehicle for restoring land. I incline to believe we have overestimated the scope of the profit motive. Is it profitable for the individual to build a beautiful home? To give his children a higher education? No, it is seldom profitable, yet we do both. These are, in fact, ethical and aesthetic premises which underlie the economic system. Once accepted, economic forces tend to align the smaller details of social organization into harmony with them. No such ethical and aesthetic premise yet exists for the condition of the land these children must live in. Our children are our signature to the roster of history. Our land is merely the place our money was made. There is, as yet, no social stigma in the possession of a gullied farm, a wrecked forest, or a polluted stream, provided the dividends suffice to send the youngsters to college. Whatever ails the land, the government will fix it. I think we have here the root of the problem. What conservation education must build is an ethical underpinning for land economics and a universal curiosity to understand the land mechanism. Conservation may then follow. Natural history. One Saturday night, not long ago, Two middle-aged farmers set the alarm clock for a dark hour of what proved to be a snowy, blowy Sunday. Milking over, they jumped into a pickup and sped for the sand counties of central Wisconsin, a region productive of tax deeds, tamaracks, and wild hay. In the evening, they returned with a truck full of young tamarack trees and a heart full of high adventure. The last tree was planted in the home marsh by lantern light. There was still the milking. In Wisconsin, man bites dog is stale news compared with farmer plants tamarack. Our farmers have been grubbing, burning, draining, and chopping tamarack since 1840. In the region where these farmers live, the tree is exterminated. Why, then, should they want to replace it? Because after 20 years, they hope to reintroduce sphagnum moss under the grove, and then ladies' slippers, pitcher plants, and the other nearly extinct wildflowers of the aboriginal Wisconsin bogs. No Extension Bureau had offered these farmers any prize for this utterly quixotic undertaking. Certainly no hope of gain motivated it. How then can one interpret its meaning? I call it revolt. Revolt against the tedium of the merely economic attitude toward land. We assume that because we had to subjugate the land to live on it, the best farm is therefore the one most completely tamed. These two farmers have learned from experience that the wholly tamed farm offers not only a slender livelihood, but a constricted life. They have caught the idea that there is pleasure to be had in raising wild crops as well as tame ones. They propose to devote a little spot of marsh to growing native wildflowers. Perhaps they wish for their land what we all wish for our children. Not only a chance to make a living, but also a chance to express and develop a rich and varied assortment of inherent capabilities, both wild and tame. What better expresses land than the plants that originally grew on it? I talk here about the pleasure to be had in wild things, about natural history studies as a combination sport and science. History has not conspired to make my task an easy one. We naturalists have much to live down. There was a time when ladies and gentlemen wandered afield not so much to learn how the world is put together, as to gather subject matter for tea-time conversation. This was the era of dicky bird ornithology, of botany expressed in bad verse, of ejaculatory vapors such as, "Ain't nature grand?" But if you will scan the amateur ornithological and botanical journals of today, you will see that a new attitude is abroad. But this is hardly the result of our present system of formal education. I know an industrial chemist who spends his spare time reconstructing the history of the passenger pigeon in its dramatic demise as a member of our fauna. The pigeon became extinct before this chemist was born, but he has dug up more knowledge of pigeons than anyone had previously possessed. How? By reading every newspaper ever printed in our state, as well as contemporary diaries, letters, and books. I estimate that he has read 100,000 documents in his search for pigeon data. This gigantic labor, which would kill any man undertaking it as a task, fills him with the keen delight of a hunter scouring the hills for scarce deer, of an archaeologist digging up Egypt for a scarab. And, of course, such an undertaking requires more than digging. After the scarab is found, its interpretation requires the highest skill. A skill not to be learned from others, but rather to be developed by the digger as he digs. Here, then, is a man who has found adventure, exploration, science, and sport, all in the backyard of current history, where millions of lesser men find only boredom. Another exploration, this time literally of a backyard, is a study of the song sparrow conducted by an Ohio housewife. This commonest of birds has been scientifically labeled and classified 100 years ago, and forthwith forgotten. Our Ohio amateur had the notion that in birds, as in people, there are things to be known over and above name, sex, and clothes. She began trapping the song sparrows in her garden, marking each with a celluloid anklet, and thus she was able to identify each individual by its colored marker, to observe and record their migrations, feedings, fightings, singings, matings, nestings, and deaths. In short, to decipher the inner workings of the sparrow community. In 10 years, she knew more about sparrow society, sparrow politics, sparrow economics, and sparrow psychology than anyone had ever learned about any bird. Science beat a path to her door. Ornithologists of all nations seek her counsel. These two amateurs happen to have achieved fame, but no thought of fame motivated their original work. Fame came ex post facto. It is not fame, however, that I am talking about. They achieved personal satisfactions which are more important than fame, and hundreds of other amateurs are achieving these satisfactions. I now ask, what is our educational system doing to encourage personal amateur scholarship in the natural history field? We can perhaps seek an answer to this question by dropping in on a typical class in a typical zoology department. We find there students memorizing the names of the bumps on the bones of a cat. It is important, of course, to study bones. Otherwise, we should never comprehend the evolutionary process by which animals came into existence. But why memorize the bumps? We are told that this is part of biological discipline. I ask, though, whether a comprehension of the living animal and how it holds its place in the sun is not an equally important part. Unfortunately, the living animal is virtually omitted from the present system of zoological education. In my own university, for example, we offer no course in ornithology or mammalogy. Botanical education is in like case, except perhaps that the displacement of interest in the living flora has been not quite so extreme. The reasons for this eviction of outdoor studies from the schools goes back into history. Laboratory biology came into existence at about the time when amateur natural history was of the dicky bird variety, and when professional natural history consisted of labeling species and amassing facts about food habits without interpreting them. In short, a growing and vital laboratory technique was, at that time, placed in competition with a stagnated outdoor technique. It was quite natural that laboratory biology soon came to be regarded as the superior form of science. As it grew, it crowded natural history out of the educational picture. The present educational marathon in memorizing the geography of bones is the aftermath of this perfectly logical process of competition. It has, of course, other justifications. Medical students need it. Zoology teachers need it. But I contend that the average citizen does not need it so badly as he needs some understanding of the living world. In the interim, field studies have developed techniques and ideas quite as scientific as those of the laboratory. The amateur student is no longer confined to pleasant ambles in the country, resulting merely in lists of species, lists of migration dates, and lists of rat types. Bird banding, feather marking, consensing, and experimental manipulations of behavior and environment are techniques available to all, and they are quantitative science. The amateur can, if he has imagination and persistence, select and solve actual scientific natural history problems as virgin as the sun. The modern view is to regard laboratory and field not as competitive, but rather as complementary studies. Curricula, however, do not yet reflect this new situation. It takes money to enlarge curricula. Hence, the average college student who inclines toward natural history avocations is rebuffed rather than encouraged by his university. Instead of being taught to see his native countryside with appreciation and intelligence, he is taught to carve cats. Let him be taught both if this is possible. But if one must be omitted, let it be the latter. To visualize more clearly the lopsidedness and sterility of biological education as a means of building citizens, let's go afield with some typical bright student and ask him some questions. We can safely assume he knows how plants grow and cats are put together. But let us test his comprehension of how the land is put together. We are driving down a country road in northern Missouri. Here is a farmstead. Look at the trees in the yard and the soil in the field, and tell us whether the original settler carved his farm out of prairie or woods. Did he eat prairie chicken or wild turkey for his Thanksgiving? What plants grew here originally, which do not grow here now? Why did they disappear? What did the prairie plants have to do with creating the corn-yielding capacity of this soil? Why does this soil erode now, but not then? Again, suppose we are touring the Ozarks. Here is an abandoned field in which the ragweed is sparse and short. Does this tell us anything about why the mortgage was foreclosed? About how long ago? Would this field be a good place to look for quail? Does short ragweed have any connection with the human story behind yonder graveyard? If all the ragweed in this watershed were short, would that tell us anything about the future of floods in the stream? About the future prospects for bass or trout? Many students would consider these questions insane, but they are not. Any amateur naturalist with a seeing eye should be able to speculate intelligently on all of them and have a lot of fun doing it. You will see, too, that modern natural history deals only incidentally with the identity of plants and animals, and only incidentally with their habits and behaviors. It deals principally with their relations to each other, their relation to the soil and water in which they grew, and their relations to the human beings who sing about my country, but see little or nothing of its inner workings. This science of relationships is called ecology. But what we call it matters nothing. The question is, does the educated citizen know he is only a cog in an ecological mechanism? That if he will work with that mechanism, his mental wealth and his material wealth can expand indefinitely? But that if he refuses to work with it, it will ultimately grind him to dust? If education does not teach us these things, then what is education for? We shall never achieve harmony with land, any more than we shall achieve absolute justice or liberty for people. In these higher aspirations, the important thing is not to achieve, but to strive. It is only in mechanical enterprises that we can expect that early or complete fruition of effort which we call success. When we say striving, we admit at the outset that the thing we need must grow from within. No striving for an idea was ever injected wholly from without. The problem, then, is how to bring about a striving for harmony with land among a people many of whom have forgotten there is any such thing as land, among whom education and culture have become almost synonymous with landlessness. This is the problem of conservation education. Wildlife in American culture. The culture of primitive peoples is often based on wildlife. Thus, the Plains Indian not only ate buffalo, but buffalo largely determined his architecture, dress, language, arts, and religion. In civilized peoples, the cultural base shifts elsewhere, but the culture nevertheless retains part of its wild roots. I here discuss the value of this wild rootage. No one can weigh or measure culture. Hence, I shall waste no time trying to do so. Suffice it to say that by common consent of thinking people, there are cultural values in the sports, customs, and experiences that renew contacts with wild things. I venture the opinion that these values are of three kinds. First, there is value in any experience that reminds us of our distinctive national origins and evolution, i.e., that stimulates awareness of history. Such awareness is nationalism in its best sense. For lack of any other short name, I shall call this, in our case, the split rail value. For example, a Boy Scout has tanned a coonskin cap and goes Daniel Booning in the willow thicket below the tracks. He is reenacting American history. He is, to that extent, culturally prepared to face the dark and bloody realities of the present. Again, a farmer boy arrives in the schoolroom reeking of muskrat. He has tended his traps before breakfast. He is reenacting the romance of the fur trade. Ontogeny repeats phylogeny in society as well as in the individual. Second, there is value in any experience that reminds us of our dependency on the soil, plant, animal, man, food chain, and of the fundamental organization of the biota. Civilization has so cluttered this elemental man-earth relation with gadgets and middlemen that awareness of it is growing dim. We fancy that the industry supports us, forgetting what supports industry. Time was when education moved toward soil, not away from it. The nursery jingle about bringing home a rabbit skin to wrap the baby bunting in is one of many reminders in folklore that man once hunted to feed and clothe his family. Third, there is value in any experience that exercises those ethical restraints collectively called sportsmanship. Our tools for the pursuit of wildlife improve faster than we do, and sportsmanship is a voluntary limitation in the use of these armaments. It is aimed to augment the role of skill and shrink the role of gadgets in the pursuit of wild things. A peculiar virtue in wildlife ethics is that the hunter ordinarily has no gallery to applaud or disapprove of his conduct. Whatever his acts, they are dictated by his own conscience rather than by a mob of onlookers. It is difficult to exaggerate the importance of this fact. Voluntary adherence to an ethical code elevates the self-respect of the sportsman, but it should not be forgotten that the voluntary disregard of the code degenerates and depraves him. For example, a common denominator of all sporting codes is not to waste good meat. Yet it is now a demonstrable fact that Wisconsin deer hunters, in their pursuit of a legal buck, kill and abandon in the woods at least one doe, fawn, or spike buck for every two legal bucks taken out. In other words, approximately half the hunters shoot any deer until a legal deer is killed. The illegal carcasses are left where they fall. Such deer hunting is not only without social value, but constitutes actual training for ethical depravity elsewhere. It seems, then, that split rail and man-earth experiences have zero or plus values, but that ethical experiences may have minus values as well. This, then, defines roughly three kinds of cultural nutriment available to our outdoor roots. It does not follow that culture is fed. The extraction of value is never automatic. Only a healthy culture can feed and grow. Is culture fed by our present forms of outdoor recreation? The pioneer period gave birth to two ideas that are the essence of split rail value in outdoor sports. One is the go light idea. The other, the one bullet, one buck idea. The pioneer went light of necessity. He shot with economy and precision because he lacked the transport, the cash, and the weapons requisite for machine gun tactics. Let it be clear, then, that in their inception, both of these ideas were forced on us. We made a virtue of necessity. In their later evolution, however, they became a code of sportsmanship, a self-imposed limitation on sport. On them is based a distinctively American tradition of self-reliance, hardihood, woodcraft, and marksmanship. These are intangibles, but they are not abstractions. Theodore Roosevelt was a great sportsman, not because he hung up many trophies, but because he expressed this intangible American tradition in words any schoolboy could understand. A more subtle and accurate expression is found in the early writings of Stuart Edward White. It is not far amiss to say that such men created cultural value by being aware of it, and by creating a pattern for its growth. Then came the gadgeteer, otherwise known as the sporting goods dealer. He has draped the American outdoorsman with an affinity of contraptions, all offered as aids to self-reliance, hardihood, woodcraft, or marksmanship, but too often functioning as substitutes for them. Gadgets fill the pockets. They dangle from neck and belt. The overflow fills the auto truck and also the trailer. Each item of outdoor equipment grows lighter and often better, but the aggregate poundage becomes tonnage. The traffic in gadgets adds up to astronomical sums, which are soberly published as representing the economic value of wildlife. But what of cultural values? As an end case, consider the duck hunter, sitting in a steel boat behind composition decoys. A putt-putt motor has brought him to the blind without exercise. Canned heat stands by to warm him in case of a chilling wind. He talks to the passing flocks on a factory caller, in what he hopes are seductive tones. Home lessons from a phonograph record have taught him how. The decoys work, despite the caller. A flock circles in. It must be shot at before it circles twice, for the marsh bristles with other sportsmen, similarly accoutred, who might shoot first. He opens up at 70 yards, for his polychoke is set for infinity, and the advertisements have told him that Super Z shells, and plenty of them, have a long reach. The flock flares. A couple of cripples scale off to die elsewhere. Is this sportsman absorbing cultural value? Or is he just feeding minks? The next blind opens up at 75 yards. How else is a fellow to get some shooting? This is duck shooting, current model. It is typical of all public grounds and of many clubs. Where is the go light idea, the one bullet tradition? The answer is not a simple one. Roosevelt did not disdain the modern rifle. White used freely the aluminum pot, the silk tent, dehydrated foods. Somehow they used mechanical aids, in moderation, without being used by them. I do not pretend to know what is moderation, or where the line is between legitimate and illegitimate gadgets. It seems clear, though, that the origin of gadgets has much to do with their cultural effects. Homemade aids to sport or outdoor life often enhance, rather than destroy, the man-earth drama. He who kills a trout with his own fly has scored two coups, not one. I use many factory-made gadgets myself. Yet there must be some limit beyond which money-bought aids to sport destroy the cultural value of sport. Not all sports have degenerated to the same extent as duck hunting. Defenders of the American tradition still exists. Perhaps the bow and arrow movement and the revival of falconry mark the beginnings of a reaction. The net trend, however, is clearly toward more and more mechanization, with a corresponding shrinkage in cultural values, especially split-rail values and ethical restraints. I have the impression that the American sportsman is puzzled. He doesn't understand what is happening to him. Bigger and better gadgets are good for industry, so why not for outdoor recreation? It has not dawned on him that outdoor recreations are essentially primitive, atavistic, that their value is a contrast value, that excessive mechanization destroys contrasts by moving the factory to the woods or to the marsh. The sportsman has no leaders to tell him what is wrong. The sporting press no longer represents sport. It has turned billboard for the gadgeteer. Wildlife administrators are too busy producing something to shoot at to worry much about the cultural value of the shooting. Because everybody from Xenophon to Teddy Roosevelt said sport has value, it is assumed that this value must be indestructible. Among non-gunpowder sports, the impact of mechanization has had diverse effects. The modern field glass, camera, and the aluminum bird band have certainly not deteriorated the cultural value of ornithology. Fishing, but for outboard motors and aluminum canoes, seems less severely mechanized than hunting. On the other hand, Motorized transport has nearly destroyed the sport of wilderness travel by leaving only fly specks of wilderness to travel in. Fox hunting with hounds, backwoods style, presents a dramatic instance of partial and perhaps harmless mechanized invasion. This is one of the purest of sports. It has real split-rail flavor. It has man-earth drama of the first water. The fox is deliberately left unshot. Hence, ethical restraint is also present. But we now follow the chase in Fords. The voice of Bugle Ann mingles with a honk of the flipper. However, no one is likely to invent a mechanical foxhound or to screw a polychoke on the hound's nose. No one is likely to teach dog training by phonograph or by other painless shortcuts. I think the gadgeteer has reached the end of his tether in dogdom. It is not quite accurate to ascribe all the ills of sport to the inventor of physical aids to sport. The advertiser invents ideas, and ideas are seldom as honest as physical objects, even though they may be equally useless. One such deserves special attention, the Where to Go department. Knowledge of the whereabouts of good hunting or fishing is a very personal form of property. It is like rod, dog, or gun, a thing to be loaned or given as a personal courtesy. But to hawk it in the marketplace of the sports column as an aid to circulation seems to me another matter. To hand it to all as sundry, as free public service, seems to me distinctly another matter. Even conservation departments now tell Tom, Dick, and Harry where the fish are biting, and where a flock of ducks has ventured to alight for a meal. All of these organized promiscuities tend to depersonalize one of the essentially personal elements in outdoor sports. I do not know where the line lies between legitimate and illegitimate practice. I am convinced, though, that where-to-go service has broken all bounds of reason. If the hunting or fishing is good, the where-to-go service suffices to attract the desired excess of sportsmen. But if it is no good, the advertiser must resort to more forcible means. One such is the fishing lottery, in which a few hatchery fish are tagged and a prize is offered for the fisherman catching the winning number. This curious hybrid between the techniques of science and of the pool hall ensures the overfishing of many an already exhausted lake and brings a glow of civic pride to many a village chamber of commerce. It is idle for the professional wildlife managers to consider themselves aloof from these affairs. The production engineer and the salesman belong to the same company. Both are tarred with the same stick. Wildlife managers are trying to raise game in the wild by manipulating its environment, and thus to convert hunting from exploitation to cropping. If the conversion takes place, how will it affect cultural values? It must be admitted that split-rail flavor and free-for-all exploitation are historically associated. Daniel Boone had scant patience with agricultural cropping, let alone wildlife cropping. Perhaps the stubborn reluctance of the one gallus sportsman to be converted to the cropping idea is an expression of his split-rail inheritance. Probably cropping is resisted because it is incompatible with one component of the split-rail tradition, free hunting. Mechanization offers no cultural substitute for the split-rail values it destroys, at least none visible to me. Cropping or management does offer a substitute, which to me has at least equal value, wild husbandry. The experience of managing land for wildlife crops has the same value as any other form of farming. It is a reminder of the man-earth relation. Moreover, ethical restraints are involved. Thus, managing game without resorting to predator control calls for ethical restraint of a high order. It may be concluded, then, that game cropping shrinks one value, split rail, but enhances both of the others. If we regard outdoor sports as a field of conflict between an immensely vigorous process of mechanization and a wholly static tradition, then the outlook for cultural values is indeed dark. But why cannot our concept of sport grow with the same vigor as our list of gadgets? Perhaps the salvation of cultural value lies in seizing the offensive. I, for one, believe that the time is ripe. Sportsmen can determine for themselves the shape of things to come. The last decade, for example, has disclosed a totally new form of sport, which does not destroy wildlife, which uses gadgets without being used by them, which outflanks the problem of posted land, and which greatly increases the human carrying capacity of a unit area. This sport knows no bag limit, no closed season. It needs teachers, but not wardens. It calls for a new woodcraft of the highest cultural value. The sport I refer to is wildlife research. Wildlife research started as a professional priestcraft. The more difficult and laborious research problems must doubtless remain in professional hands, but there are plenty of problems suitable for all grades of amateurs. In the field of mechanical inventions, research has long since spread to amateurs. In the biological field, the sport value of amateur research is just beginning to be realized. Thus, Margaret Morse Nice, an amateur ornithologist, studied song sparrows in her backyard. She has become a world authority on bird behavior and has outthought and outworked many a professional student of social organization in birds. Charles L. Broly, a banker, banded eagles for fun. He discovered a hitherto unknown fact, that some eagles nest in the south in winter and then go vacationing to the north woods. Norman and Stuart Criddle, wheat ranchers on the Manitoba prairies, studied the fauna and flora of their farm and became recognized authorities on everything from local botany to wildlife cycles. Elliot S. Barker, cowman in the New Mexico mountains, has written one of the two best books on that elusive cat, The Mountain Lion. Do not let anyone tell you that these people made work out of play. They simply realized that the most fun lies in seeing and studying the unknown. Ornithology, mammalogy, and botany, as now known to most amateurs, are but kindergarten games compared with what is possible for, and open to, amateurs in these fields. One reason for this is that the whole structure of biological education, including education in wildlife, is aimed to perpetuate the professional monopoly on research. To the amateur are allotted only make-believe voyages of discovery, to verify what professional authority already knows. What the youth needs to be told is that a ship is a building in his own mental dry dock, a ship with freedom of the seas. In my opinion, the promotion of wildlife research sports is the most important job confronting the profession of wildlife management. Wildlife has still another value, now visible only to a few ecologists, but of potential importance to the whole human enterprise. We now know that animal populations have behavior patterns of which the individual animal is unaware, but which he nevertheless helps to execute. Thus, the rabbit is unaware of cycles, but he is the vehicle for cycles. We cannot discern these behavior patterns in the individual or in short periods of time. The most intense scrutiny of an individual rabbit tells us nothing of cycles. The cycle concept springs from a scrutiny of the mass through decades. This raises the disquieting question. Do human populations have behavior patterns of which we are unaware, but which we help to execute? Are mobs and wars, unrests and revolutions, cut of such cloth? Many historians and philosophers persist in interpreting our mass behaviors as the collective result of individual acts of volition. The whole subject matter of diplomacy assumes that the political group has the properties of an honorable person. On the other hand, some economists see the whole of society as a plaything for processes, our knowledge of which is largely ex post facto. It is reasonable to suppose that our social processes have a higher volitional content than those of the rabbit, but it is also reasonable to suppose that we, as a species, contain population behavior patterns of which nothing is known, because circumstance has never evoked them. We may have others, the meaning of which we have misread. This state of doubt about the fundamentals of human population behavior lends exceptional interest and exceptional value to the only available analog, the higher animals. Errington, among others, has pointed out the cultural value of these animal analogs. For centuries, this rich library of knowledge has been inaccessible to us because we did not know where or how to look for it. Ecology is now teaching us to search in animal populations for analogies to our own problems. By learning how some small part of the biota ticks, we can guess how the whole mechanism ticks. The ability to perceive these deeper meanings and to appraise them critically is the woodcraft of the future. To sum up, wildlife once fed us and shaped our culture. It still yields us pleasure for leisure hours, but we try to reap that pleasure by modern machinery and thus destroy part of its value. Reaping it by modern mentality would yield not only pleasure, but wisdom as well. The Deer Swath. One hot afternoon in August, I sat under the elm, idling, when I saw a deer pass across a small opening a quarter mile east. A deer trail crosses our farm, and at this point, any deer traveling is briefly visible from the shack. I then realized that half an hour before, I had moved my chair to the best spot for watching the deer trail, that I had done this habitually for years, without being clearly conscious of it. This led to the thought that by cutting some brush, I could widen the zone of visibility. Before night, the swath was cleared, and within the month, I detected several deer which otherwise could likely have passed unseen. The new deer swath was pointed out to a series of weekend guests for the purpose of watching their later reactions to it. It was soon clear that most of them forgot it quickly, while others watched it, as I did, whenever chance allowed. The upshot was the realization that there are four categories of outdoorsmen: deer hunters, duck hunters, bird hunters, and non-hunters. These categories have nothing to do with sex or age or accoutrements. They represent four diverse habits of the human eye. The deer hunter habitually watches the next bend. The duck hunter watches the skyline. The bird hunter watches the dog. The non-hunter does not watch. When the deer hunter sits down, he sits where he can see ahead and with his back to something. The duck hunter sits where he can see overhead and behind something. The non-hunter sits where he is comfortable. None of these watches the dogs. The bird hunter watches only the dog and always knows where the dog is, whether or not visible at the moment. The dog's nose is the bird hunter's eye. Many hunters who carry a shotgun in season have never learned to watch the dog or to interpret his reactions to scent. There are good outdoorsmen who do not conform to these categories. There is the ornithologist who hunts by ear and uses the eye only to follow up on what his ear has detected. There is the botanist who hunts by eye, but at much closer range. He is a marvel at finding plants, but seldom sees birds or mammals. There is the forester who sees only trees, and the insects and fungi that prey upon trees. He is oblivious to all else. And finally, there is the sportsman who sees only game, and regards all else as of little interest or value. There is one elusive mode of hunting which I cannot associate exclusively with any of these groups: the search for scats, tracks, feathers, dens, roostings, rubbings, dustings, diggings, feedings, fightings, or preyings, collectively known to woodsmen as reading sign. This skill is rare, and too often seems to be inverse to book learning. The counterpart of reading animal sign exists in the plant field, but skill is equally rare in occurrence and elusive in distribution. To prove this, I cite the African explorer who detected the scratchings of a lion on the bark of a tree 20 feet up. The scratchings, he said, had been made when the tree was young. The biological jack-of-all-trades, called ecologist, tries to be and do all these things. Needless to say, he does not succeed.